Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 15th, 2021, the Mature Minor Edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast. I am in Vermont, not in Washington, D.C. I'm in Vermont, great green state, Vermont. I'm joined by John Dickerson of CBS Sunday Morning, CBS Face the Nation. Hello, John Dickerson from New York.
Hello, David.
From his new home in New York, I think.
No, I'm not in the new home yet.
Oh, you're not in the new home yet?
No, I'm in the very room in which you spent the night.
You're very small on my screen, so I couldn't really tell where you are. And yeah, also, no, I just look into your eyes, John. I can't see anything around you.
We found a new place to live, but we haven't moved there yet.
And Emily, as promised last week, is on vacation, a well-deserved vacation. And so we are joined by beloved GabFest regular, Josie Duffy Rice, who's a writer in Atlanta. Hello, Josie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So this week, will Democrats figure out a way to defend voting rights, to protect voting rights? Then a new front in the vaccine war. Also, what kind of country has a vaccine war? Should kids be allowed to vaccinate themselves over their parents' objections? And then a fascinating new podcast, 1 Year, tries to make sense of the year 1977. We'll be joined by host Josh Levine to talk about 1977. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. Texas Democrats fled the state to stop there being a legislative quorum in order to prevent or delay passage of a voting restrictions bill. Again, to try to delay passage of a voting restrictions bill, they were back in emergency session that had been called because they delayed this voting restrictions bill before. Republicans who fully control Texas government legislatively and at the gubernatorial level, they're adamant that they're going to push through this voting restriction bill and had an emergency session to do it. Texas is, of course, just the latest state where Republicans are pushing major new restrictions on voting, even as Democrats in Washington, who have their own legislative desires to expand voting rights and expand access to the ballot, are struggling to find a way to get a bill that they could possibly pass, certainly, you know, even to get 50 votes for. Josie, the core of this fight is the big lie that the overwhelming majority of Republicans have embraced, or the majority of Republicans have embraced. Yeah, kind of the overwhelming majority. Mm-hmm. Stick with overwhelming. Which is that Donald Trump won the election and rampant cheating through the office of the presidency to Biden. So it strikes me that ultimately these sort of state-level voting fights are important and they are real restrictions that Texas wants to do. But until there is acceptance of legitimacy of the election by Republicans, these are really small issues compared to that big issue, which is that the millions of people who support one of the major parties in this country no longer are willing to vouch for the credibility of elections.
Yeah, you know, I find this whole thing just so, even taking the emotion out of it, just so bizarre, because it really has been hijacked by what I think was probably very predictable, this adamant belief that Donald Trump actually won the election. This is a historical pattern, right? Republicans have always tried to limit access to the ballot box. They've done it a number of different ways. When the left has pointed out that these restrictions and also these abnormalities could really have an effect on our belief of, you know, on trust in the electoral system, we've been ignored. And so the fact that that narrative has been kind of taken over by the right now is both unsurprising and alarming, because it really does signify what feels like when I think back to a couple years ago when I was working on voting rights policy, we thought about voting rights as an area where we could be on the offensive, where we actually thought there were ways in which we could do stuff like automatic voter registration, letting even 16-year-olds vote in certain local elections. There were sort of all these ways that we thought about expanding the franchise. And now we are so clearly on the defensive, and it seems like we'll be on the defensive for the next decade at least, largely because, like you said, an entire sector of the population now has no trust in the electoral process at all.
And I think, David, it's even larger than the big lie. I think actually there's a huge set of kind of satellite issues around that, which might be even more powerful in galvanizing the entire party. I mean, the bigger lie is that voter fraud is a big problem requiring all of this emergency action. I mean, the number of people who were charged with voting fraud in the entire country in 2020 could fit on an airport shuttle bus. There are that few of them. Mm-hmm. And so despite the absolutely tiny little examples of real fraud, not crazy conspiracy theories, not insane bananas stuff, the problem is so teeny tiny, and yet there is this massive effort across all levels of Republican government to stamp out this problem. And why does that exist? Not because there's evidence that it needs to be stamped out, but because there is this market that was created by the big lie. But if you are in support of, you know, stamping out fraud, you're not all the way as crazy as believing that Donald Trump won, but you're able to say something that still accesses the people who believe Donald Trump won and other Republicans. So it's kind of the safe space for people like, say, Mitch McConnell, who don't believe, you know, that Donald Trump won. And the reason we know it's a power move and not something that's being designed to root out a real problem is because of the overwhelming number of Republicans across the country who are offering basically similar measures, which is a way to use their power to keep power, which politicians have been doing since the beginning of time.
And it's also, I think, a reminder that America, as much as it claims to be the most liberal democracy in history, is not and has never actually been a real democracy. It has always limited the access to the ballot for certain groups or certain people. And then even when it is ostensibly equal, has made it more difficult for people to vote, whether it be 8-hour lines or voter ID or shutting down polling places or voter purges. I mean, all of these are ways in which we limit the franchise, disproportionately hurting especially people of color, but also people, poor people, and really people who are going to vote, who are more likely to vote for someone, you know, on left of center. It is really, to me, just such a shameful part of our institutional processes that we take these fights as anything remotely legitimate. We discuss them in any sort of remotely legitimate way when we know what they are. We know what they are because this is the history of America trying to limit people's ability to you know, participate in the civic process.
I'm less troubled in some ways by the Texas law than I am by the efforts, which we've seen in a bunch of states, which would allow action to overturn election results after the fact.
14 states have enacted laws that give partisan officials more control over the election oversight.
Those efforts seem to me to be, in a way, even more dangerous than the efforts to kind of constrain when and where people can vote. Because the nice thing about people voting is that people will make the effort to vote. Now, it is totally unfair the way the restrictions are put disproportionately on poor people and people of color. And it's grotesque, but like at least, you know, people can still get out and vote. If the vote is then able to be uncertified, state legislature able to step in and alter the result after the fact, that's a much more troubling situation to me.
This is being debated by Mitch McConnell on the general topic of voter suppression is being discussed. He says, you know, these laws are merely trying to wind down the emergency COVID measures that were put in place in 2020. But those laws that allow partisan officials more control over the elections have nothing to do with COVID. They have nothing to do with anything that was put in place in 2020. What they're directly aimed at is the big lie from President Trump that somehow voting didn't take place, you know, in the proper way in 2020.
Now, I wonder if this Supreme Court, which has shown no appetite at all to protect the easy franchise, they've shown no appetite at all to protect the right of people to easily get to vote, whether they will be also unwilling to step in if state legislatures overstep their bounds. I'm worried about that.
Well, the recent decision on Arizona, in which they upheld the decision of the local state legislatures, which suggests that they have no appetite for that. But the underlying premise behind your point, David, is the reason you don't want legislatures to have the ability to nullify an election is because the people who are making the decision are the ones whose basic interests are at stake. When we debate about vaccines or about climate policy or anything else, you can make some case that there might be a reason applied to the issue to win the argument. But in this case, they are the ones whose future is at stake if the election doesn't go their way. And mm-hmm. so giving them control over which way the election goes, they're a little bit compromised in that decision.
John, why do you think it is that there is this increasing recognition among Democrats? I think an almost universal recognition among Democrats that the field is very tilted against them, that the way gerrymandering in Republican states has helped Republicans, whereas there's much less in Democratic states, not none, but much less, the way the generic House ballot overwhelmingly favors Republican, the way the Electoral College overwhelmingly favors Republican, the way these voting restrictions are being put in ways that overwhelmingly favor Republicans is a kind of existential, not existential, it's a massive threat to the Democratic Party. It's also a massive threat to the very notion of electoral democracy in this country. And yet the efforts to constrain that, even the bills that have been proposed, like the John Lewis Act in Congress, are pretty minor, and they're not going to pass anyway. Like, why if this is such a serious threat and so many people recognize it as a serious threat, is the legislative response or even the political response so weak in comparison?
Well, I guess a couple of things. One, and I would add in that the fact that Joe Biden, who says this is the greatest threat since the Civil War, which is maybe overdoing it a bit, isn't going the if you really, really believe that, then Joe Biden would say we must end the filibuster today. And the idea that like he's not going to muck in with what the Senate is, the prerogatives of the Senate, he doesn't want to cross that boundary is kind of silly. If you're talking about this really is the greatest threat since the Civil War. So that would seem to support your point a little bit more. The For the People Act seems to me to be stronger than the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. I mean, it automatic voter registration ends gerrymandering, requires early voting for 2 weeks. That does seem to be a stronger measure than you're talking about, David. But I think one of the problems is obviously ending the filibuster, which would allow some of these laws perhaps to pass, is in the hands of two Democratic senators who don't want to do it. I think also there's a lot of way in which President Biden's speech this week, with its overheated rhetoric and a lot of the upset about this, which because there's not as much very much that the president can do, actually, but the upset at him and the desire to have him go out and give the kind of speech he gave this week is about telling Democratic voters, get out and vote in 2022. I mean, this is a base motivation effort in addition to the underlying cause, which I'm not saying is invalid. I'm just saying there are two tracks here. And part of what President Biden is trying to do is say, get out and vote. And so the interesting question for political scientists is, in 2022, let's imagine Republicans pass no voting restrictions. Would the turnout of Democratic voters without these voting restrictions be as high as it will be now that there's going to be basically a systemic campaign from now until Election Day in 2022 in which Democrats are told the vote is being taken from you, which is a great turnout mechanism? Which would be higher? No provisions and some other motivation, or provisions passed and the motivation of having your vote be threatened?
Untestable hypothesis. Josie, yes. I would like you to connect these things that are happening in Texas. One, an extraordinarily restrictive abortion law that the legislature just passed that would give citizens the right to sue to stop other citizens from getting an abortion and just punish doctors who might provide abortions. Two, another law the legislature just passed that essentially allows anyone who wants to carry a gun around without a permit in Texas. These voting restrictions that are going to be passed by emergency session. And at the same time, the lack of any significant legislative action in Texas over the power grid failure that killed hundreds of people and paralyzed the state this winter. Or maybe it was this spring even. What is going on in Texas and in your state of Georgia that is causing this kind of discordancy between the issues that are affecting most of the people in the state and the issues that these legislatures are focusing on?
I think on one hand, this is yet another sign of like right-wing prizing of freedom and liberty gone amok, just completely warped. You see what happens when a state kind of siphons out all of its public responsibility to keep up basic things like utilities and the power grid, while saying it's fighting for citizens because it's ensuring your freedom. That freedom they're framing is the freedom to punish people for taking care of their bodies, or the freedom to carry a gun everywhere publicly without having to register. And so I think what we see here yet again, and especially with the voting rights laws, is who does the Texas legislature, the Georgia legislature, but really the Republican Party, who do they think deserve freedom and who doesn't? Apparently the answer is not women who have the right to choose, as the Supreme Court has held and will probably at least hold for a few more months before they inevitably overturn Roe. Also, you know, who has the right to be free from gun violence, right? Who has the right to show up and vote? I don't know how sustainable this is, because I do think that there is a sense of discomfort with government that refuses to do basic stuff like hold up infrastructure. But a lot of this is, as you said, a culture war based on a sort of moral panic around these issues that has been perpetuated by the right. And what worries me is just that this is a cycle. It doesn't get better. It doesn't inevitably get better. The move into a world in which we confuse freedom and liberty for an operative society continues, and it's kind of driven by what we see happening in Texas and what we see happening in other states.
Slate Plus members, you get no ads on any Slate podcast. You get bonus episodes of shows like Slow Burn, and you get bonus segments on the Gabfest every week. This week, we're going to be talking about classical music. How bad is it anyway? That's going to be our Slate Plus topic this week. If you go to slate.com/GabFestPlus, you can become a member today. Slate.com/GabFestPlus is just $1 for your first month. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Tennessee is a vaccination mess. The vaccination rates are quite low for COVID, the COVID vaccine. Now the state's top immunization leader, Dr. Michelle Fiscus, is out. Fiscus had distributed a memo that just confirmed Tennessee law, which states that some teenagers who are called mature minors, so 14 to 18-year-olds, under certain circumstances, could be eligible for vaccines without their parents' consent. And that really infuriated a lot of Republican legislators in Tennessee. She was pushed out of state government. All state-sponsored vaccine efforts aimed at kids have been stopped. Even state-sponsored vaccine efforts that have nothing to do with the COVID vaccine, that have to do with just regular vaccination, have been discouraged, and the state is not promoting regular vaccination for kids. This incident in Tennessee just raised or highlighted a discussion that's going on all around the country, which is, what are the rights of children to be vaccinated if their parents don't want them to be vaccinated? Because we have enormous numbers of people in this country who are skeptical of vaccinations and don't want their kids to be vaccinated. And then you have kids who are increasingly self-aware and intelligent and educated, who want to make the choice to get vaccinated. And where do those two things butt up against each other? So, Josie, you're a lawyer. Should mature minors, should someone who is, let's start with this. Should a five-year-old be allowed to get vaccinated without their parents' permission?
Oh, it's such a hard question.
A 5-year-old? That's not a hard question.
It is not a tough question, I guess, objectively. But I think subjectively, the truth is that all of these questions are really hard. And that, like, at some point, what the line is between, like, what you should be able, when you can decide what to do with your body and when you can't, is hard to define. Should the government be able to make the decision of what you do in your household and what a child gets to do? Or is that a parent's decision? And I think, like, it's complicated.
All right. 10-year-old, 14-year-old,
right.
17-year-old.
14-year-old, I think you can make that decision at 14. But then I guess I think that if you decide you don't want to get vaccinated, your parents should make you. So this kind of goes, I guess it just only depends on what your decision actually is.
John Dickerson.
What I love about this question is I think one of the major parts of it is that the reason these laws are in place is the science and the idea that up until a certain age, you don't understand how to perceive risk as a teenager. You don't necessarily know how to make decisions about these kinds of things in your health and welfare because you just haven't developed sufficiently. However, in our modern political climate in which madness prevails, and madness that is particularly that to which adults are particularly susceptible, do we have to think of a whole new way of thinking on this kind of issue where, in fact, the adults are more susceptible to lack of impulse control, lack of risk perception because of the political climate in which they've marinated themselves, and so that they are actually thinking less clearly than a 14-year-old? I don't know that anybody could make that case in court, but it's not clear at all that the adults who are denying the kids access to vaccinations are doing so based on clear reason. Now,
right.
you may decide that there's a societal good in just allowing parents to have control over their kids until they're 18. But to the extent the law is based on the idea that the older people are thinking more clearly, I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that they are not thinking more clearly. And then the second question I would ask to both of you is it okay to weaken the standards, whatever they may be and however they may derive, for when an adolescent has autonomy? Is it okay to weaken those if there's a public health good in doing so? You know, so in this case, the doctors would make the case that if you get more adolescents vaccinated, it's better for the adolescents. Numbers are creeping up, largely because the adults are getting vaccinated. And then secondarily, there is asymptomatic transmission as a result of adolescents who are infected but aren't showing symptoms, which has a public health disadvantage, obviously.
I think it is true that parents are often irrational. They often act impulsively around their children. But children often act impulsively around their parents, too. Everyone is susceptible to the vagaries of life. If you're saying that maybe it's okay for a 14-year-old to make the decision to get vaccinated, would you say the same thing that a 14-year-old could make the decision not to get vaccinated?
Right. And I think that's the hard question.
Against their parents' wishes?
Because...
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, I think my opinion does kind of change. I think the public health goal here, right, is vaccination. And so, but that's obviously not how the law works and not how policy should work. That's not how we should make decisions. So it's a really tough question. I have a 3-year-old and a 10-month-old, and if they could get vaccinated if tomorrow they said they're eligible for the COVID vaccine, I'm not sure that I would immediately rush out to vaccinate my 10-month-old with something that there's not more evidence of, probably. But at what age would I be totally fine doing that? I think by 14, I'd be more okay with it. And I don't have bright line rules for when I'm okay with things as a parent and when I'm not. And you can see how this, even people who support vaccination, this becomes kind of a complicated topic when you're talking about your own children and you're talking about a new vaccine.
I mean, I think the thing that makes vaccines different than other health interventions is that other health interventions, for the most part, are individual health interventions to affect the health, to improve the health of an individual person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whereas a vaccine is a health intervention to improve the health of a society. And that the act of one person doing it, it's valuable for that one person. I'm certainly very glad I have a COVID vaccination. I'm glad I just got my shingles vaccination. But mostly, or not mostly, but it is also hugely valuable in increasing the protection that all of us feel. And therefore, there has to be some bias built into the law that for a health measure that is broadly a public health measure that society deems important and that medical officials deem urgent, that the preference is vaccination unless, that the unless has to be pretty strong. The preference the law gives towards vaccination needs to be strong in a way that it doesn't need to be strong for things which are just private, but private medical acts.
Do you think that's still true in a situation like this one where kids really aren't that at risk, right? I mean, it is true that COVID has ravaged the nation and killed more than 500,000 people, but most of those, the vast, I mean, I think 0.05% of them, right, were children. I think that's around 300 people. That's not nothing. We don't want to pretend like that's nothing, but we also, what is the severity of the public health problem that we're trying to address among the population that we're willing to override either right. an individual's autonomy to say no or a parent's autonomy to say, I don't want this for my child.
And does that change? So it is changing a little bit with the Delta variant, which more kids seem to be getting.
Right.
And you also have this asymptomatic transmission issue, and you have the problem with long COVID, which even though adolescents, when they get sick, in some cases don't get as sick as adults, although in a lot of this Delta stuff, at least what I've been reading, they've been getting super sick. Nevertheless, the issues with long COVID and irregular heartbeat lasting for 75 days and memory issues and all kinds of other things, our understanding of the downside of getting sick is evolving. David, can I reframe your question back to you, which is, does the public health equation, I guess this is for both of you, change on vaccines in a way that was different with masks? And by what I mean by that is, if you make a local decision to give parents control over vaccination in a local area, because other parts of the country are vaccinated, it's essentially a localized decision. When you were not choosing to mandate masks, and we were which was during a period of no vaccination, your choice to not wear a mask could in fact hurt somebody 10 states over because the virus could hop over into other states. But now that vaccines have essentially walled off places like Vermont and Massachusetts where vaccine rates are high, is this more of a local decision and therefore different than public health decisions that we made at a national level during the earlier period of COVID?
It occurs to me that in an era where distrust of government, and especially federal government, is so high in so many ways on so many planes, that having a local effort, right, a community effort from people that maybe you trust, you recognize, you feel like they are more familiar to your environment, is probably the best way to go in terms of actually ensuring that people feel comfortable getting vaccines. Because ultimately, what we're talking about is so much bigger. I mean, on one hand, there maybe isn't much bigger than this vaccine and the impact that COVID has had, but also just the attempt to force people to do something when the fact that they don't want to do it is a sign of the institutional rot to begin with, right? And we're in a tough position because the way that we used to think about vaccination and anti-vaxxers were they were fringe and most reasonable people will make the reasonable decision. And we're seeing now that the population of people who don't want this vaccine, don't want their children to get this vaccine, et cetera, has grown. And so it strikes me that like actually having a local effort probably is the best way to go. This is not going to be like a national come together moment around the vaccine for everybody. Yeah. And so we need people within communities to actually be making that point.
Yeah, that brings us back to Tennessee. I think that's a great point, Josie, that what we have in a situation in Tennessee where because of this blow-up over the mature minor situation, vaccination in that state is at risk, not merely for COVID, but for all diseases. So mm-hmm. kids are not going to get their MMR vaccines. They're mm-hmm. not going to get their HPV vaccines, their hepatitis vaccines, which are essential for the public health and essential for their health. The entire Republican infrastructure of the state is now turned against vaccines overall. And that's tragic. It'd be much better for there to be sort of a Tennessee way to fight vaccinations. Obviously, it'd be better if we lived in a society where there was universal support for vaccination and it mm-hmm. wasn't a problem. But absent that, a Tennessee way to vaccinate people is better than no way to vaccinate people. And so I would endorse that. I also, just as a final point on this kind of minors vaccinating themselves point, I think it is such a controversial issue and it probably affects so few kids that it's almost not worth having the fight about. People should just be like, okay, parents make this decision. Let's not have this fight. Because if this fight inflames people so much that it makes the anti-vax sentiment even higher, it's going to do damage, as we were seeing in Tennessee. So like, let's just not have the fight. Let's not allow teenagers to vaccinate themselves and just accept that that's a loss for a few hundred kids around the country.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Our beloved Slate colleague Josh Levine has just started a new podcast, 1 year, and it is not how long it will last. It is about 1 year. It looks at episodes in a single year, episodes that help shape what we become. And he started with the year 1977. That's his first season. And his first episode, it is an incredible account of Anita Bryant and the fight over an anti-gay ordinance in Miami in 1977. The second episode is about the fall of Jimmy Carter's pro-marijuana drug czar and how that helped shape pot policy for a generation till now. So Josh, welcome to the GabFest. You've been on the GabFest. Welcome back to the GabFest.
Yes.
I think you've been on, sure.
I've been on several times. Always a pleasure. Just knowing that you remember so fondly my times on the GabFest makes it even more delightful to be here.
So what is the premise of 1 year as a overall show? And then why 1977 as a year that changed everything?
So the premise of it, kind of coming off of working on Slow Burn for 5 seasons now, excited about the 6th season as well with Joel Anderson on the LA riots, you know, having done that show where the DNA is looking at these huge events that have had extremely consequential impacts on the way that we live now and looking at them extremely closely and seeing what it is that we remember, maybe how that memory is wrong, what it is that we've forgotten. Wanting to use that kind of toolkit, but applying it to a whole bunch of different events and seeing how they bounce off of each other. What are some of the kind of connections and resonances? Understanding that when, like, say, Watergate is happening or the Iraq War is happening, there's 10, 20, a million other things going on in America that are also influencing the way that our politics works, our culture works, and maybe having the opportunity to also examine things that aren't the biggest stories in American history, I thought could be fruitful and fulfilling as well. And then why 1977? I've always been fascinated with that period in our history, which sits between the Nixon era and the Reagan era. And it's this like brief moment when it seemed like something extremely different was happening. There's all these possibilities that are opening up after Watergate and after Vietnam. You can kind of argue that the country that we live in now is starting to take shape in particular ways, but also a lot of the promise of that moment was unfulfilled and unrealized. And so sitting in that moment and trying to figure out why things happened the way that they did was a project that I was very interested in.
All right. So, Josh, tell us about the first episode.
Yeah. So in 1977, there was this gay rights ordinance that came up in Dade County, Florida, which is Miami, where it was basically just adding affectional or sexual preference to this ordinance, saying that you can't discriminate against people by affectional or sexual preference in employment and housing and public accommodations. And this hadn't been a particularly controversial thing around the country. There had been nearly 40 cities that had adopted this language, and it did get actually adopted by the county commissioners in Dade County, except as it's getting adopted, Anita Bryant, who's this Christian entertainer, former beauty queen, orange juice spokeswoman, steps forward and decides, I'm going to fight this. And she fights it on the local level, but the kind of vigor and enthusiasm and the sort of outrageous rhetoric. And, you know, she starts this organization, Save Our Children, and you can tell what the rhetoric is just based on the name of the organization, inflames this local fight into what essentially becomes a national referendum on homosexuality.
Just looking at the episodes, Josh, I was kind of shocked at how so much of this feels like it could be 2021. I mean, thinking about the gay ordinance and the Save Our Children and the bathrooms, and then, you know, Jimmy Carter being the first president to endorse legalization of marijuana. This is not a question. This is just a comment. I'm one of those annoying people that gives a comment, not a question. But I'm excited about this in particular because it feels like so much of it still resonates. Literally, the same fights are still resonating right now.
Yes. What I found in reading and also listening to what the anti-gay rhetoric was in 1977 is that it hits the exact same beats and often uses the exact same language as anti-trans rhetoric in 2021. And so there is this feeling that we're fighting the exact same battles, or the exact same battles are being fought. Mm-hmm. But the terrain has just shifted a little bit, but the sides are the same, and the kind of even the arguments. And on marijuana, I mean, Chuck Schumer just introduced legislation on Wednesday of this week to decriminalize marijuana on a federal level. I mean, this is a thing that's, and there's not any expectation that it will pass. So maybe in 10 years, another senator will introduce legislation. But that is a fight, again, where we're sitting in 2021 around legalization and decriminalization. We're in a very different place than we were back then. But the arguments are really similar. And I think it is really helpful to understand the history and where we've been to kind of get a sense of why things are playing out the way they are now.
When you see those currents, Josh, the anti-gay rhetoric in 1977 with Anita Bryant seems to connect to the anti-counterculture part of the conservative message from the 60s, Wallace, Nixon. So you can see where that starts earlier and carries through this. But one thing that didn't exist in 1977 that exists today and that's familiar from these flashpoint cultural things that are sort of created out of nowhere is there wasn't a media structure to feed all that through, or was there? In other words, how did this become a national issue when you didn't have a cable channel devoted to promoting individual cultural moments? How did that happen in 1977 with a much different media landscape?
Yeah, so first, just to connect to your previous point, another kind of conservative movement that was happening right at the same time that we're not doing a standalone episode on, but is just sort of looming over everything, is the fight over the Equal Rights Amendment. And Phyllis Schlafly and Anita Bryant are talked about as this kind of dyad, but also they often appear together. And so those are things that are kind
of... I conflate them in my head. I honestly, it like took me decades to separate them.
Well, you know, one reason I think that might be the case is that this sounds ridiculous, but they both got pied in the face in 1977. And so that was another thing that was happening a lot, was people were getting pied in the face in 1977. But back to your question, John, I think a couple things. First, there was a lot of neighbor-to-neighbor kind of community conversations going on with the Save Our Children thing. A lot of it was in church that people were receiving these sort of messages and sermons about what Anita Bryant was doing. But she was on the cover of all the news magazines. She was on the network news. The newspapers were covering this. National newspapers were sending reporters down to Miami. So there was, I think, very broad awareness of what was going on. And on the gay rights side of things, the real kind of comprehensive, close-to-the-ground coverage was happening in gay community newspapers, whereas the quote-unquote mainstream newspapers were often presenting the Save Our Children side as the side. And, you know, the Miami Herald there took on an editorial stance that was very pro Anita Bryant. They would run the Save Our Children ads that were saying very literally gay men were assaulting children, promoting that vicious lie that gay men were a threat and a menace. And this was allowed to run and was being kind of promulgated without any question by this newspaper. Whatever media ecosystem did exist back then, the story was amply covered by it. And that coverage was, I think, tilted in a particular direction.
Josh, I want to go back to the premise of 1 year as an entire structure from a sort of historical perspective. I think I proposed once when I was at Slate that we put a whole bunch of numbers in a hat for years, like going back to like 1100, you know, 1342, 1726, and you just pull.
Would this have to be like Jamiroquai's hat? Like how big of a hat are we talking about?
A sorting hat. You'd pick a number out and you'd have to write the 1726, the year that changed everything, or, you know, 1904, the year that changed everything. And the premise, my kind of basic belief, having looked at, you know, all these books about 1968, 1491, 1861, but then there are books like our colleague Fred Kaplan wrote a book, 1959, the year that changed everything. I don't know if that's the actual subtitle, Fred, but it was close to that. Is it totally arbitrary what year you pick? Is every year equally available for 1 year? Or is it, in fact, are there years that really change things more than other years?
I think, the premise of the show isn't that 1977 changed everything more than Fred Kaplan's year changed everything, or more than 1142 changed everything.
Oof, I good think, year, 1142. Venerable Bede.
Hard to find people from 1142 that are both available and willing to be interviewed about their experiences during that year. So there's some really practical reasons to choose a year from more recent history. But part of it is honestly is practical, that I wanted to pick a period that felt like history, but then wasn't so distant that we couldn't talk to people that were present in these moments. I was familiar with the 70s from the research that I had done for my book on the welfare queen phenomenon. And I also didn't want to choose a year that was dominated by one standalone single event. I wanted it to feel honest and true to say, like, to understand this year, you need to understand all of these sort of disparate things that were happening and the connections between them. And so, I'm not making an argument that, screw 1978. It's all about 1977. I'm interested in this period. Let's look at a list of, you know, do some preliminary research, look at the list. And this was a year that seemed potentially fruitful and interesting. Am I underselling it, Plotz?
Well,
it is actually the year that changed everything.
You're kind of answering the question backwards, which is, if you'd picked 1978, would you get just as fruitful? Is every year just as fruitful? Does history, in fact, have any pattern, any rises and falls?
Well, it depends whether how you choose the initiating event. So in 1977, I think Apple's incorporated. So you can draw the entire history of the personal computer from that event. It didn't happen in 1977, right, but it was initiated in 77. So if you chose 77, you could say all these following things happened and these currents that created Apple were beginning, and that has changed modern life as we know it.
As we would expect from John, he has hacked the algorithm of one year.
Yeah, but if you pick 1978, you could say that's the year Atari was incorporated.
Yeah.
Or that's the year Apple introduced its first product, and therefore...
Precisely.
Yeah, I think that what we found is that it's a really useful constraint. Like, I'm sure you guys can relate to this in various projects that you've done. There are some constraints that are not useful because you end up having to throw out things that are really good stories because they don't fit whatever your narrow premise is. But the premise of 1 year is extraordinarily capacious in that you can tell any kind of story in a calendar year. You can tell stories about politics and culture and science and religion and sports. And I do think, to answer your initial question, David, you can find really great stories on those subjects in any given year, and they'll just add up to something different. And so, the argument of the series is less to understand this year, you'll understand all of American history. It's like, to understand this year, here are the stories that will help you understand it.
Am I getting ahead of myself if I ask you what your next year will be, what season two, what the year will be?
I don't think we've announced that yet, Josie, but I'll tell you that it's in the 90s.
Can we guess?
Ooh.
Or you, will you not great. Tell us? You won't tell us.
I mean, you have 10 guesses. Why don't you just guess all of them?
You're not going to tell us.
I will not tell you.
I wonder if you could do a Neanderthal, either a Neanderthal year or a Neanderthal event, which is to say something that seemed to be absolutely raging in 1977 and had lots and lots of news magazine covers written about the scourge of X or the fundamental reorientation of human life resulting from X that then just never panned out. That was just like Y2K or something that, you know, just never met all the expectations of the moment, as a kind of corollary question to David's.
We are doing an episode on Laetrile. Do you guys know what Laetrile is?
I remember Laetrile.
I don't.
No.
That was a thing that was going to change everything, maybe, and now nobody really knows what it is. It was a cancer drug, and it became this battle where state legislatures all over the country legalized this thing, often saying, we don't think it works, but people should have the freedom to choose their medical treatment. It was very, like, very kind of directly and consciously, like, post Roe v. Wade rhetoric around the right to choose. And doctors were saying, this is total quackery. This thing doesn't work, and it's actually going to be harmful to people. But there was this kind of current and belief that people should be given the opportunity to do what they think is best. And it, you know, the story we tell at the center of it gets to be extremely fraught around who has the right to choose for who. It's a really fascinating story. And it is a great example of a thing that if you were in 1977, you would have done a bunch of segments about it on the Gabfest. Everybody knew what Laetrile was and had an opinion about it. And our producer, Evan Chung, is doing that.
It's from Apricot Pits, right?
Wow.
It was from Apricot Pits.
Josh Levine has a new podcast, 1 Year. It's great.
Thank you, David.
Check it out wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you all.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're having some extremely cold drink, because I'm sure Atlanta is frighteningly, terrifyingly hot, what are you going to be chattering about with your loved ones, Josie?
I am going to be talking about the thing I've been talking about nonstop in my household, which is this book, Detransition Baby. Have we already done this one?
No. Nope.
I don't think so.
Oh, this is amazing. Because every time I do a cocktail chatter, I'm late. So I'm very excited to be talking about this. This book, Detransition Baby, which was written by Tori Peters, and is just her debut book. I mean, the title really tells you everything it's about. It's about two trans women who were in a relationship together. One of them detransitioned, and the other one wants to have a family and a baby, and the trans woman who detransitioned is now in a relationship with her boss. Anyway, it's a complicated story, but it's amazingly written by Tori Peters, who is a trans woman. It's incredible. I enjoyed every second of reading it, and I highly recommend.
All right. That sounds good. I need a read. John Dickerson, what's your chatter?
Mine's a double chatter. The first is that it appears that Italy has prohibited all large cruise ships into Venice, which Venice is this tiny jewel of a city, which is a bit of a canary in the coal mine for the march of modernity. It's being assaulted by the rise of sea level. They've put up basically a barrier that rises out of the sea to block, which was successfully deployed to keep the floods from eroding the beauties of Venice, and the cruise ships do the same thing by not only what they do to the canals, but also what the disgorgement of so many people on the streets of Venice have done. So it's a small way to look at the larger issues of climate change and of just basically our rapacious modern desires trampling on the beauties of antiquity. So they've, in a somewhat of a surprise move, denied, I believe, all major big cruise ships. The other thing is the New York Times has a fascinating feature where you can look up the change in the temperature of wherever you were born. You just put in where you were born and the year, and it will show you how many days basically how the temperature has increased over the course of your lifetime. So I was born in McLean, Virginia. There were 13 days above 90 degrees in McLean, Virginia. And by the time I am 80, there will be 50 of such days. So it just is a tidy way of showing the unimpeded march of temperature increases in wherever you were born.
Yeah. I mean, the scary ones aren't like McLean, Virginia. The scary ones are, you know, in South Texas or Alabama or, God forbid, mm-hmm. parts of India where it's not, you know, it's not 13 to 50. It's, you know, 70 to 300.
Sure.
And it's mm-hmm. just, it's frightening. It's a frightening.
Although to the extent that it brings it home to you, in other words,
yeah.
people could say, oh, well, I don't live in one of those crazy places. I'm fine. It does kind of show you that, in fact, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah. I grew up in a house in D.C. without air conditioning. And it wasn't suffering. It was fine. That is really hard to do now. My chatter is entirely self-interested. I want to announce something about CityCast, my beloved CityCast, my day job. We create daily podcasts and newsletters for cities around the country. We launched in Chicago and Denver in March. And I hope if you live in Chicago and Denver, you've had a chance to listen to our podcast and to get our newsletter. So you can go to citycast.fm to do that. And I'm really excited that because we've sort of seen this starting to work and we've seen extremely engaged audiences that want a new kind of news for their city, that we're about to expand. And we're going to add 8 new cities to CityCast.
Wow.
So I want you to know about this. If you live in one of those cities, I want you to sign up to get our newsletter and sign up to be told when the podcast is launched. And if you're somebody who works in journalism, maybe we've got a job for you because we're hiring in these cities. So these cities are Boise, Houston, Las Vegas, Nashville, Oakland, Omaha, Pittsburgh, and Salt Lake City. So please go to citycast.fm/jobs if you're interested in a job with us, or citycast.fm just to put your name on an email list. But GabFest listeners have been a great core of our Denver and Chicago audience and have GabFest listeners have also recommended great colleagues to me, and I'm working with people who listen to the GabFest who heard about it here. So if you are in any of those cities or know people in any of those cities, Boise, Houston, Las Vegas, Nashville, Oakland, Omaha, Pittsburgh, or Salt Lake City, please check out citycast.fm.
And when you add a 9th city, Atlanta is here.
Yeah.
Atlanta's coming. New York City's coming. Joss's Twin Cities is coming. We're already in Bridget's Chicago. Emily's New Haven may have to wait. Listeners, you have sent us awesome chatters. You continue to send them to us by tweeting them to us at @SlateGabFest. And this week's listener chatter comes from Chris Heiberger, and he's recommending a New Yorker story about environmental activism in the Catholic Church. And it has a GabFest hook, which I'll tell you about at the end.
Hey, GabFest. This is Chris Heiberger from Brooklyn, New York, and my chatter this week is about a remarkable story in The New Yorker from February written by David Owen titled How a Young Activist is Helping Pope Francis Battle Climate Change. It's about a woman named Molly Burhans, a cartographer and environmentalist and polymath who is trying to move the Catholic Church to take action on climate change through better land management and make good on the Pope's Laudato Si encyclical on our moral responsibility to take care of the earth. Molly has an incredible personal story and unique combination of interests, and she's founded an organization called Good Lands, which uses GIS mapping technology and data analysis to reveal insights into all sorts of issues, from the environment to where to build new schools to how to protect children from abuse. So the piece is about the importance of data infrastructure, but also about how change can happen in large institutions. Again, the story is How a Young Activist is Helping Pope Francis Battle Climate Change in The New Yorker. And she's also featured in the latest episode of the Solvable podcast put out by Pushkin Industries. I highly recommend everyone check those out. Thanks.
All right. So what's the GabFest hook? The GabFest hook is that Solvable is produced by none other than our very own producer, Jocelyn Frank. So, Joss, you're all over the GabFest this week. Mazel tov. That is our show for today. The GabFest is produced, as I just said, by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Audio. June Thomas is managing producer. And Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. And please tweet chatter to us there. It doesn't have to be chatter that involves one of us. For always delightful Jesse Duffy Rice in Atlanta and John Dickerson in New York. I'm David Plotz.
Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, it's so great having you, Jesse. Come back anytime. I think you're coming back again this summer, maybe. I can't remember.
I am.
Good.
I'm very excited.
Yay. We will talk to you all next week, and we'll talk to Jesse soon. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? So I have a confession. The confession is, I don't even know why we're doing this as a Slate Plus. This is just, I had like almost allergic hive-like reaction to something yesterday, which was that I'm staying with my parents in Vermont for a few days with one of my kids, and my father loves to listen to classical music. And so they put on some classical music. It was Sibelius, I think. I think that's a classical composer. And I almost broke out into hives. I couldn't stand it. I cannot stand being in rooms where classical music is played. And I just want to get to the bottom of it. Is it my fault, or is classical music just terrible and no one is admitting it? Or is it just something that's wrong with me because of some daddy issue where, because my father loves classical music, I have revolted against it? But my mother loves folk music and I love folk music. So what is happening? I never feel guilty about not having read a book. I never feel guilty about like not speaking a language. I feel really guilty and ashamed that I loathe classical music, and there's something wrong with me. So what's wrong with me, John?
Well, that is such an open area for inquiry. But on this narrow question, is it all classical music? You can't stand any classical music, or it's just certain kinds of classical music?
There's like a few pieces which I know pretty well from childhood. So the Brahms's Academic Festival Overture, I love. There's a leader, Beethoven or maybe Schubert, Undefernte Geliebte, which there's a Cecilia Bartoli that my father used to play for me that I love. And occasionally I'll listen to an opera and be like, that opera is pretty good. I like an opera. But almost everything else, I can't stand it.
Sure. Well, because what I'm wondering is, I have a somewhat similar feeling with jazz music, which is that it's not similar at all. But I do recognize an inkling of what you're talking about, which is some jazz music, despite my overwhelming affection for jazz and the ability to be deeply moved by some jazz, some of it is absolutely a disaster. And if I hear it, I can't do anything else. I wonder if it's the fact that classical music should be appreciated, that you're basically trying to eat a delicious meal in the wrong context, that classical music is best listened to and concentrated on by itself, but that it has become the background music of our lives in a way that is both inconsistent with the form and reminds you.
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.